everybody, and welcome back to another season of Frights of the Round Table. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and I've got my awesome, awesome co-host here. How you doing, Anna?
Doing good. How are you?
Good, good. And we've got a special guest here. How are you doing, Ron Newcomb?
I'm doing well. I appreciate you all having me.
Yeah. Ron and I have known each other for quite a while, I guess. Yeah. We've been friends on Facebook, and ever since I think I saw first your Fellowship of the
had a couple different names. It was a feature film called Rise of the Fellowship,
or
another name is The Fellowship Rise of the Gamers.
Oh God, I remember when that came out like that. I was like, what does that even mean? Right?
Yeah, it was their guild name. So that was kind of the play on words there.
Yeah. So can you tell us, how did you get started in filmmaking?
I got in way of acting. So I had kind of played sports my whole adolescence. And when I went to college, they really didn't have any athletic teams. So I had always wanted to try my hand at acting and had done some small plays when I was really little and remember loving it. I was what I would call a closet gamer. So we would play D&D and stuff on weekends, but I would never tell my, athletic friends that I was out there playing Dungeons and Dragons back in the 80s. Now it's, very cool to do so. But back in the day, we all kind of just geeked out at each other's houses on weekends and had a lot of fun doing it and really became addicted to story and the power story and telling those kind of communal adventures and having those together in a role-playing game. And then, again, when I went to college, I auditioned for a play, got cast in it and won a few acting awards and just got addicted further into story by acting and thought acting was what I was going to do, but nobody was begging to produce my stuff or bring a young actor on. So I ended up producing by default and writing along the way. I think a lot of creatives have that writing bug. I wouldn't say I'm a great writer, but I'm a good enough writer and was able to partner up with some great writers and then fell in love with directing. So that was kind of my path. I think every filmmaker has kind of a unique story of how they got into it, and mine is unique as well.
Definitely.
Nice.
Anna, did you have something you wanted to ask?
Oh, I was swatting at the cat, but I do have a question. Do you like directing better than acting and producing and in writing and everything else?
I definitely found a love for directing. I still love to act, and most people don't think of me as an actor these days. They think more of what they call the hyphenated, which is producer, writer, director type. But I do love to act still. So nice. I would think there's kind of equal passions there. Producing is probably the least of, though. I like taking a project and birthing it and bringing it to fruition. Every film will fight you every step of the way. So it takes the tenacity of the producer to bring it forward. And so I've learned to appreciate what the producer role does and what it means. And, that's where the projects really get made, is the passion of the producer. Most people think of the director. So I've appreciated the producer type and that you want to scratch, and it allows you to, world build and deep dive into character. And I also think as it's a crucial component, whether or not you're gifted at it or not, to understand it and know it. So I have a high respect for writers, and it all starts with the power of story. And that's a crucial component. Yeah. But between directing and acting, there's probably equal loves there, but I still very much do love to get a chance to act.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, and I love what you said there, because I kind of agree exactly with you on the producing aspect of it, because I believe you and I are both like creatives,
Yeah.
Creatives aren't very much into like the business side of everything. We're more into if I could have like unlimited money or whatever and not have to worry about anything, I would go crazy, because then I would just like all my creative energy would just be flowing into whatever. But unfortunately, that's not the way indie films work. you know, yeah. you have to get you have to get whatever money you can, then you have to go and make the movie you can make on that budget. Did you find that Rise of the Fellowship, when you were making it, kind of suffered from like a lower budget, or do you think
I believe that a lower budget film makes you be creative with problem solving. You know, as an independent filmmaker, I joke around and say I could almost back into any budget. You know, like, how much is this film? Well, how much do we have? You know, and I can back into it. So if we have 100 grand, okay, then that, you know, that's my budget, lo and behold. And I think, you know, money spends fast in filmmaking, and you need to get creative with it. And with Rise of the Fellowship, we were certainly taking it very serious and was trying to have a very professional set and environment and try to tell the story that we wanted to tell, which is a coming of age story about these four geeky gamers that parallels Lord of the Rings. And they learned that there's a little bit of geek and hero in all of us. And the Lord of the Rings IP had just come out with the third film, and we had gotten permission to use the video game in there. So I didn't have the money to hire an A-list talent, but I was able to attach the Lord of the Rings IP kind of sideways. I came at it a different angle, and it was definitely due to having limited funds, you know, not being able to hire Viggo Mortensen to pull him in, or Sean Astin or somebody. You know, we had to work with what we had. And in truth, you know, I know what the film is and I know what it isn't. It's very endearing and sweet to me. It was intended to be a family-friendly coming-of-age story that was targeting kind of young teens. The distribution company had a little bit different view of the way they were trying to market it. I don't fault them. They know their audience and what would sell, but they were trying to sell it more as like an action-adventure film, which it really is not. It's more of a sweet, you know, family-friendly comedy is really what it is. And again, we had to get very creative in how we were solving problems. At the time, digital was just deciding if it was going to be a thing or not. And the Red camera had just come out. So we were fortunate enough to, now it seems like everybody has a Red, but at the time there were very few Red cameras out there. And we had a nice Red one camera and a nice lens package, and we spent money on that. We spent money on sound, because you have to, you know, hear a film, and a lot of independent films, you go, man, that wasn't very good, you know, or you blame it on the actor, and really it was bad sound or something like that, you know. So we wanted our sound to be good, and we had a great post-production facility that did our sound design, and we knew those things were going to be important. But the rest of it, yeah, we just had to get creative. And I think not having an abundance of capital, and I'm very entrepreneurial, I love kind of the business side of it too. I don't love the trying to raise money, but I can appreciate.
Who does?
Yeah, right. You know, yeah, there's very few. I have met a few, but there's very few producers that love that. That's their angle. You know, you mentioned a creative. The produce, there's a title called a creative producer, and there are those producers that don't necessarily focus on the creative. They're focusing on more of the business side of things. But yeah, I mean, you know, the lack of capital breeds ingenuity. And I believe that that's true.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit, like, after it was released, what, yeah, like, how did it, how did it get out, and how well did it do?
Yeah. So we ended up, as a result of having the Lord of the Rings attached to it, again, by way of a video game, we got distribution. And that certainly was why we got distribution. You know, they were trying to parlay that into the success of the Lord of the Rings, and knew people were just going to devour it based upon the content alone, that content affiliation. And so we had a nice distribution deal. A company, our sales agent called Highland Film Group, was our international sales agent. And then there is what's called a domestic distributor. And that was E1 or Entertainment One. At the time they were called Phase 4, but they were bought out by E1, which was now, I think, bought out by Hasbro, the toy company. And that's because they're wanting to get stories out there. You're going to see some of the stuff, you know, that's coming online with their stories. And it got out there very traditional. It first went to the international markets, and this is where people from all over the world come and go to buy product for their country. There's very specific, most of them know of them as film festivals, but the why they are so popular is generally because there's usually a film market is going on in tandem with that. So America, it's the American film market, which happens every year in around November timeframe in Santa Monica, California. And they literally have these hotels. They'll take out all the beds in the hotel rooms and make these hotel rooms little offices. And you go around, and people from all over the world go around for their country. So you might get someone from, you know, the Philippines that's looking to buy, they have a certain budget range and they're looking to buy 20, 30 films, and they might do theatrical releases. They might do TV, and your film is one of the many that is being shopped around to try to make these sales. And then they can decide how they're going to recoup a lot of the their money for it. So we did pretty well internationally. That's one good thing about fantasy, is that it translates very nicely internationally. Every continent, there's a dragon mythos. And so, you know, an American comedy might not translate all the time, and so they might not be as appealing, but a fantasy or sci-fi or even an action film sells really well internationally. We found that to be the case for us. And then we sold in Walmart. When DVDs, you know, were still a thing, it was right as the DVDs were dying, but we did come in and make some sales in DVDs, and we were on Netflix and Amazon and all that. We didn't get a theatrical release, but we knew, I mean, at our price point, we knew that wasn't really going to be for us. And so we made a small festival run, but again, our intent was to get the film out there to get seen. But we did win a couple film festivals, which always helps. But it was really about getting out to the fans. You know, we didn't make this film for everybody. It was for a niche audience. And the fans that have found its voice have loved and appreciated the film.
Yeah. You mentioned, basically a lot of like sci-fi and horror films and things that actually do go internationally. And that makes me like think of like how Paranormal Activity was like this like kind of fluke kind of thing. Nobody's really done what Paranormal Activity did, which was what Blair Witch did before, which was make a project that was so small, you know, at the time, I think when they actually shot it, it was like $20,000, and, you know, make it, you know, market it and do all these other things. Obviously not everybody's able to have like somebody do a lot of P&A. By the way, for some people who may not know what that is, Princeton Advertising, for films that are, you know, made today, you know, for independent films. So the fact that anybody gets like the distribution deals that they get these days is sometimes remarkable, you know, like, and back when you first did it, I mean, I'm sure there was a lot of films in the market that were competing against yours too. So,
oh yeah, you only need to go to one market to realize how inundated it is. I mean, it's literally, you know, we might have 400 theatrical releases in the States, and there's thousands, tens of thousands of films that get made every year. So, I mean, think about that. You know, there's everybody's competing for eyeballs. And now again, 10 years ago, the international market was 40% of sales. Now it's 60%. China will overtake the US in consumership of film content. They are tracking to have more theaters open than we will. So China is tracking to be very high. India is tracking to be, right now they're second, China's third, but China is tracking to actually, if you're wanting to get into the business and you're trying to get your film told, your story told, your film out there, you need to know what or who the audience is, and you need to be thinking internationally. And, you know, and that includes from the genre to what content is out there. Like a drama is going to be hard to get made in an independent world in 2021. A comedy can be a challenge, again, because it doesn't always translate internationally well. They do well domestically because usually of the star affiliation. A lot of independents want to think that the star power doesn't mean as much today as it did 10 years ago. And now it seems that stars, in my opinion, matter even more because there's so much noise. You know, the CEO, I believe, of Netflix said he was not afraid of the studios. He was afraid of Fortnite. You know, and the what he means by that is we're competing for eyeballs on a Friday night. Are you going to stop what you're doing? And are you going to watch Netflix? You know, and the consumer, the person today watching a movie, it's really entertainment. It might be a movie tonight. It might be a video game tomorrow. We're all competing for eyeballs. And so if you have an unknown drama, for instance, and no one's in it, you have to be realistic of what that looks like from a consumer's point of view or a buyer's point of view. And unless there's a name attached, it's going to be a difficult sale. And there is that chicken and the egg in the film industry, unfortunately, where you don't get a name attached without money. And many times you don't get the money without a name attached. And it's this conundrum that we find ourselves in as indie filmmakers. But you got to be tenacious. That's what a good producer does, is find, you know, recognizes that truth and finds ways to get their stories told anyways.
Exactly. Anno, did you have anything? Like, you look like you're wanting to ask something.
No, I was just listening intently and the cat bothered me again. I gotta get them out.
No,
they're
okay.
Interested in what's going on in the screen. So
oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
But then, no, I do have a question.
Yeah.
Like,
you know, actors actually, and ironically, musicians, I have found, are two of the, they're easier to find.
Yeah.
There's tons of actors and tons of musicians or those people that would like to score or compose. But actors, it's not too difficult to find them. But to your point, how do you kind of weed through them and find the ones that are going to be good and deliver? And I would also say, you know, there's a lot of people with talent. You only need to go to your local theater, your community theater. And some of these people should be on Broadway. And yet here they are, due to life circumstances or whatever, they're in your little community theater. And but that same professionalism is there and you can find them. And once you greenlight a project, there's something to be said about forward momentum. Just the fact that you greenlight something and get it moving, suddenly the word gets out. And it's now never been easier to kind of help get the word out, at least locally, to say, hey, I am making a film. If you're doing a narrative film, people get excited about that, particularly actors, because if you're in an environment where there's not a lot happening, then you know, they're usually having to spawn. There's no sizzle in what a feature film can bring. And so the moment you say, hey, I'm going to do a feature film, suddenly there's buzz and talk, and there's sites that you can go to specifically for your region, your jurisdiction. There's community theater. There's almost every state has a film office. And so you can call them and let them know that you're going to be auditioning and casting. And actors now have become, and that's non-gender specific, they become very good at creating reels and doing Zoom calls and auditions. And you just need to put the call out, particularly if you're paying, even if it's not a crazy amount of money, it's an honest earning. And just that alone will give you a certain professional level, just the fact that you're paying. And then what I did was I held auditions. You know, at the time, obviously this is way pre-COVID, but in a COVID world, I think it's taught us that technology is the thing we should embrace. And again, you can be doing Zoom calls all day, and you could have actors reading lines or do a monologue, record themselves. And, you know, you're not looking for the quality or professionalism of the video making, you're looking for that actor. And that's one way to find them. I found that the lead actor, or like the themselves as an actor per se, like a leading man or woman, but those are the ones that you really need to go and hunt down and try to find them. Like, you know, you have a short person, tall person, muscular, but you know, something that's really defined or unique, suddenly that becomes the hunt for, you know, who you're trying to find. And then it's also the ensemble. You know, it's not just how the individual acts together, but how does the collective act together? And particularly if you're casting, like, let's say a family, you know, does mom and dad and the kids all look right? Are they going to act together? You know, it's things like that that you're thinking of that the actor has no control over, but that you, the producer, are trying to make sure that is meshing because you want the best representation to be captured on screen. But I would also say that if there is a way to attach a talent, I firmly believe that you still should be trying to attach a talent. Now, that could lead us down a whole nother conversation of what, when I say talent, I mean a name talent. By that, I mean what can turn sales by their very name can actually translate into dollars. You know, we, for the Rangers, this epic fantasy action adventure project that I did, we cast a social media presence. So somebody who's very popular on social media, and they helped promote it. You know, getting unique people like that can, I believe, also help. But the rule of thumb is if you're casting an actor that you're hoping is going to move the sales needle, if you have to explain them who they are, like, oh, it was the third, you know, person from the left on Game of Thrones, you know, that person is who we cast, that's probably not a named talent. You know, they're not going to move the needle. In fact, I've had friends that spent quite a bit of money on a particular actor, and he's a great actor, but in the end, did he move the needle? They had to say, no, he didn't. And so they spent all this money on whom they thought would be someone that was going to move the needle. Well, then the question becomes, how do you find out who's moving the needle? And that's where you need a sales agent. And a sales agent can help you determine, yes, if you get, you know, Tom Cruise in your film, that is going to translate to money. If
what?
You get Daniel.
No way.
Yeah. If you get Alec Baldwin, if you get, you know, these people, Travis Fennell, you know, you're going to move the needle. And a sales agent can tell you who is bankable, because that's really by attaching a talent, a bankable.
Interesting.
Star.
Thank you.
Yeah. Very.
Well, my just so you guys know, my internet's been like messing up my connection, so I like there've been parts where I don't hear you guys, and I'm just hoping that that does not come with the recording, because it seems like you guys can hear each other, you know.
Yeah.
So like I didn't
yours
catch
yours keeps going out.
What?
Yours is going out sometimes though.
Yeah. See, that's the problem.
But his is going constant, so I can hear everything that's being said.
Okay. Good. And it's not okay. So it's okay. Good.
No, that's, it's not constant in you either.
Yeah, I don't. This is why I can't wait to go back to Virginia. You know, move back there, because this internet, you know, in LA is not good. So
I know how that is. Mexico is horrible.
So I'm hoping
unlimited internet right now.
I mean, I guess I'm not on unlimited internet. I don't know. So it's
really. Yeah, ours is limited. It's like 2.4 gigabytes and you're done.
Oh, but
I can still use my WhatsApp.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And Facebook. So I was like, that's weird. Now Mexico is backwards.
I don't know.
You ever film here? It's backwards here.
that gets.
Oh, God. Uh-oh.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Okay. I was going to say, Ron, did you ever want to film in Mexico?
Yeah, Mexico, you know, like the country of Mexico or
New Mexico? Yeah. Just regular Mexico.
Mexico? International filming, particularly in like South America. That's part of the sizzle and fun and the beauty of filmmaking, right? I mean, who doesn't love to travel and go to other countries? And Mexico in particular, you know, they have beautiful landscapes and locations that you just, you know, that translate very nicely on film. And then what I love about that also, like if Robert Rodriguez, if you read his book and, you know, his first film, they filmed down in Mexico, is that even a small film, they treat you big, you know, because they don't get a ton of film to come through and they treat you like, you know, a professional. And so, yeah, they put all the stops. And Robert Rodriguez, here's this college dude at the time, you know, but because he has a camera, they're like able to shut the streets down and, you know, do what they want to. So I would love to film in Mexico. I've dreamed of filming in Ireland because I do a lot of fantasy and sci-fi You know, they have castles there, of course. And they also not only though need to have the beautiful locations, they also need to have the crew. And they also need to have a financial incentive. So that's the other reason why a lot of people film where they film. I have friends that took their entire TV series over to Serbia to film. And it's because it's cheaper over there and they have the infrastructure to be able to, you know, film. And of course it's beautiful and picturesque. It's all that. We have a lot of that here in the States though. It's productions will follow the money at the end of the day. So
yeah,
I would love to film internationally or in South America or Canada or, you know, plenty of places in the States I'd love to film.
Well, if you ever make it to Mexico, let me know.
They have a nice incentive.
I'll throw you around.
So yeah, absolutely.
So I want to talk real quick, Ron, about transmedia, you know, which seems to be a thing that you're into, you know?
I believe in, you know, I had to stop saying I'm a filmmaker and start saying I'm a storyteller, because there's so many mediums that I would love to tell a story in, from, you know, filmmaking to, I love this. And I think that's, you know, I don't know if it's going to take over, but it, you know, I think we're going to see more of that. I love that as an opportunity. I love comic books, you know, I love role-playing games. I love video games. I love board games. And so I started to say that I'm a storyteller, and it almost doesn't matter what medium that I get to tell my stories in. Like, I'm taking the Rangers and turning it into an animated version, which has been a lot of fun. And you know, who wouldn't want to kind of live in that world? And it, but it's very different. It's a huge learning curve. And I'm finishing up a comic book and never really thought I would get into that, but I just love the way the comic has turned out. So I'm currently producing a audio drama podcast. So think of it like the old 1940s storytelling on the radio, where you have a full sound design, a ton of actors. You know, it's not an audio book. This is a fully designed audio drama, and I'm doing one of those. So there's a lot of ways to tell stories.
That's awesome, because that's exactly what my company is doing, you know, with stuff, Sick Flick Productions. We're making, we created the Echo Lake universe, you know, so very much. Can you guys hear me now? Okay.
Yeah.
I can hear you guys. Okay. Well, I was just saying, like, inspired by like people like Marvel and are the companies like Marvel that are just out there doing, you know, lots of cool stuff. And, I read a book. There's a book, by a guy named Houston Howard called, You're Gonna Need a Bigger Story. Have you read that?
No, man. I'm a big reader. So no, I'm gonna put that on my list.
You're definitely, since you seem to be into this, it's all about building a bigger story world and everything, which seems to be what you're really into. So
nice.
Yeah, no, 100% agree. That is accurate. I'm going to look that one up.
Okay.
I'm writing it down.
Yeah. He's really good. He's a really good, you know, author. And it's amazing what, transmedia basically is doing for like the indie world, especially.
Yeah. I mean, podcasts are getting picked up and turned into TV shows, and, you know, they're still pilfering from the comic book and graphic world novel. And, you know, so transmedia, again, I don't think we should limit ourselves to potentially just being a narrative filmmaker. And who wouldn't want to do an episodic, you know? Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, I would. So, yeah, I love the idea of transmedia and I embrace it wholeheartedly. So in fact, I spent a couple hours today working on a board game. So again, it's just another way to expand our IP. And I partnered up with some guys that do these amazing miniatures, but then people will be able to bring the world of the Rangers, you know, on the tabletop. So it's been a lot of fun.
That is amazing, because that's exactly what this book talks about too, is how we have all these other people we could connect with that know how to do all that stuff, you know? Yeah. Right. And so you just talk to this person and you say, hey, you know, do you want to come with me on this, you know, and stuff, and you get a percentage or whatever, you know, you work out deals, and then people will do this stuff for you. And, you know, and then you've got these amazing other creations that, you know, you can sell.
Yeah. The Rangers, which again is this fantasy story, we actually turned it into an experiential live event. And what I mean by that is we had 250 people come out for a weekend, dress up in the world of the Rangers, and we all live as though we are in the world of the Rangers. And we have weapons that are padded, weapons that are safe, and we actually battle each other and raise a horn in the evenings with meat in it. I mean, there's nothing cooler, you know, and it's a world that I co-created. It's hard to take. The moment you become a filmmaker and you invite other people to co-create with you, the collaboration is one of the things I love. And so, you know, I can't take ownership too tightly in my projects, because once you birth them out there and other people start putting it on, it's a group. It's kind of like D&D, you know, it's not just the dungeon master that's doing it. It's also the players contribute to the story. So the world of the Rangers is now a weekend warrior, and we do it every year. We're now in our fourth year, where every one time every year, again, we have about 150 people to 200 people come out, and we literally live in the world of the Rangers. And the, you should see some of the pictures, just check out weekendwarriorexperience.com. And the pictures alone will speak for itself. And we take it very, very seriously. And it's a beautiful backdrop. But, you know, to your point, I have a Rangers miniatures. I have a Ranger card game. I'm working on a board game. I have another guy that's working on a novel. So, you know, it's kind of the George Lucas approach. You know, George Lucas made more money on the toys than he did the films. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, Disney is in the business of selling toys, not filmmaking. Films are giant commercials for their toys. You know, they're trying to sell the mouse. That's what they're doing. And you know, I am a student of that. And so I'm trying to get my stories told. And, you know, a film is one of the unique things where when you write a script, it's not intended to be read. It's intended to be seen. So the viewer is part of that experience. Only a viewer can bring a film life, you know? And so I that transmedia approach, that collective communal storytelling, I fully.
Okay. Okay, awesome. Well, great. Sorry, it's just like it keeps messing up on me. So it's like, I'm like, you know, but it's okay. I'm hoping that, like I said, I'm hoping that since you guys can hear each other, you know, that it all is okay.
I'm just cut out.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So sorry so about everybody. That. Anyway, sorry. This is what happens when you do Zoom and you have like bad internet. So let's talk. So you got Rangers. So is there like a full length movie that's come out, or has it just been, you know?
It's a 60 minute opportunity. So it was a pilot episode of an episodic series that we wanted to do. And so I, as a result of creating this content, because I'm from the DC area, we put together think tanks really well. So I put together a think tank of other creatives in the fantasy sci-fi space. And as a result of that, we ended up forming a streaming distribution platform called the Fantasy Network. So if you go to thefantasy.network, it's a streaming platform. There are transmedia elements of the world of the Rangers as well. But the Rangers we have, I have, you know, I don't know a producer out there that doesn't have a list of projects that they're working on, and I'm no different. I have 23 projects that are not just ideas, I'm talking that are fleshed out. Some of them are in script format. Some have, you know, pitch decks and ready to go and could pull the trigger tomorrow if I had the financing. Money's not a problem, it's the problem for indie filmmakers. And so we have to, you know, find ways to overcome that.
Definitely. I know, I agree, because I've got a million scripts that are just like waiting, to get made. And it's just a matter of like, you know, when we start doing it, you know, like when we start getting funding and everything. But, you know, yeah, that's kind of what you got to do, you know, just keep making, just keep creating art. What's been the toughest project that you think you've been able to do?
Can I be excused really quick? I got to open the door.
Okay, sure.
I have to lock myself out. Okay, y'all continue.
Okay.
Yeah, so the toughest, yeah. You want me to hold?
Oh, no. Go ahead. Go ahead.
So, yeah, the toughest project, you know, each project has its own uniqueness that is going to be a challenge. In fact, I like to say that every film will fight you every step of the way. It doesn't want to be brought to life. It will resist you. And it's the tenaciousness of the producer that has to pull a film into existence. So every film has been extremely difficult to finish, complete, and get out the door. You won't believe this, but it's in the 80s to 90% most film projects, and this includes shorts even, wipe out in post-production. They don't even finish. Can you imagine that? You go through all that trouble and then they don't get finished for whatever reason. And it's because each film is a challenge. Each one is hard, from financing to people not having the same creative vision to, you know, a film is made three times: when you write it, when you shoot it, when you edit it. And when you edit it, when you first see your first cut, it's just like reading your first draft. You know, you're not defining the story. You got to break the story each of those steps in writing, in filming, and in post. And you have to stay with it. The story will come through. Rare is the person like Kevin Smith that, you know, edits while they shoot, and the moment they're done filming, they're ready to go. So every project has been extremely difficult to finish, but I finished all of my projects. There's one project that I'm still working on to complete, but I've been able to finish all the projects that I started out and committed to do. And I think that's important, you know, even for the people, not all of them that turned out the way I wanted. You know, I know what they are and what they are not. But I'm proud of them, and I was proud of the team, you know, that came together. And for a moment in time, we put ourselves out there. And, you mm-hmm. know, people are quick to judge. You know, we've created a group of what I call not critics, but criticals. You know, they're critical. I don't care. You could put up a kitten video, and there's going to be someone that's going to thumbs down it. You know, mm-hmm. and you can't live for that audience. Like, I didn't make Rangers for everyone. I made it for those that would find it and appreciate it. Same with the, and so people that say I didn't like it, I'm like, that's fine, you know, but I didn't make it for you. I made it for the people that would see it for what it is, you know? And I think that's important to remember as artists. You could get 1,000 thumbs up and you get 1 thumbs down, and you're going to fixate on the thumbs down. And we need to, because we're artists, we wear our hearts in our sleeves, and we're art, again, is meant to be seen, consumed, read, you know, whatever it is. And so you're putting yourselves out there, but we've created a critical nature in people, which is very unfortunate.
Yeah, I agree. I was reading one of the, like, a couple of the reviews on like Letterboxd of one of my movies, and it was very negative and everything. Wow. And I was not upset about it by any means, because I like, look, I put my art out there. Anybody can say whatever they want, you know? And sometimes I like to look at that things as like, maybe this was a good thing. You know, like maybe some of their critique is something I could work on, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, you know, it I do believe what I believe it was Roosevelt that said, it's the gladiator in the arena. You know, it's the critic doesn't count. It's the gladiator in the arena fighting their way through that counts and matters. And that's the artist, that's the filmmaker. You know, the critic doesn't get to have a voice unless we give it to them. And, you know, you're putting yourself out there, and I can at least appreciate the attempt at something. I can appreciate what somebody trying to do. I can see a film that, yeah, maybe doesn't execute on all things, but I can find the good a lot of times in those film projects. And you know, there is, you don't hit home runs every time out the gate. Rare is the filmmaker that does that. Even, you know, the Spielbergs, every film of his wasn't a home run, you know, most of them, but you know, not everyone is a home run, and you are going to learn and get better out there. Film is one of the few mediums to where you're expected your first time out to crush it. And then you're judged only by your last film. It doesn't matter if they liked one of your other films, and this film that comes out, they could just totally hate it and they think you're the worst ever. You're only as good as your last film. So you can't be doing it for the criticals. You have to find your voice and your audience and do it for them.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? I'll say this to Steven Spielberg. To every like 1941 that somebody makes, somebody's going to like it. You know, there's going to be that audience. And yeah. I met a guy that says he loves 1941. So that goes to prove, like, even if the criticals hate it or whatever, you know, everybody hates it or what, you know, there are going to be people that do that enjoy it. So, I mean,
no, now it's nostalgic. I mean, I remember watching that film when I was young, you know, now it's become, you know, a little bit of like a cult classic type thing. It's funnier now than it was then. So
exactly.
I've never seen it.
Good. Yeah. It's funny.
I have to check it out.
Yeah.
It's definitely not like, you know, it's Jaws or something, but it was like his attempt at a comedy, you know, and maybe, I mean, honestly, I bet if it was directed by Robert Zemeckis, it would have gotten a different response, you know, or something, but because it was Steven Spielberg, I think a lot of people didn't like it because they were expecting something different from him.
That's right. Yeah.
And everything. So, I mean, you know, so what have you been up to like lately, Ron?
So, you know, I have these 23 projects I've been working on. I told you about the board game. I've been working on the podcast is in a very interesting space right now. You know, these stories that have a full sound design and full a bunch of actors. I love those. If you haven't listened to any, they're a great way to get into a story. And as a filmmaker, it's a lower cost of entry and it sounds amazing. That's been a lot of fun. So I've been working on that. Been doing writing. You know, I have a regular full-time job. I married with 5 kids and I have a house payment just like everything else. So I have certain responsibilities. And I think sometimes as creatives, we can somehow you're a failure. And I've had to reposition that and say, no, you're just responsible. You know, you're paying your bills. So there's certainly a lot of my day is just the grind of being responsible, right? Being a husband, a father, and those things and paying my bills. But from the creative side, it's been those things. And then I also believe that everybody should have kind of like at least 3 projects if you're a writer. You should have the project that only like the studios can make. Budget's not an object. You should have a project within like the $1 million range that you're definitely going to need some help with. And then you should have the project that you can film right now with your friends. And I think all 3 of those are valuable. And so I have those projects, and I have one low budget action film that I'm going to pull the trigger on, at least for now, that I'd like to try to pull the trigger on. And I've been working on that script. I have another script that I'm co-writing. I have a comic book that I'm finishing up. So I keep myself busy. I definitely keep myself busy.
That's good. Well, that's good. I'm really excited to hear more, like, you know, more about the board game and other stuff that you got going on at some point, because that's just amazing to me.
Yeah. It is something that, you know, from an entrepreneur, I didn't realize, like, the margins aren't great. You're not going to make, you know, millions of dollars, but it is another great way to get your story out there and into the hands of people. And we're in a little bit of a boom for board games. Actually, we've been in one, right? And Kickstarter and crowdfunding in general has just gotten hard. It is just gruelingly hard to do. And even for like a feature film, you might be able to raise like 20 grand these days. But for a physical product, for whatever reason, they do very, very well on crowdfunding. And so that's the other thing I've noticed, is that it allows you to come at storytelling from a different point of view and actually get some capital in that can make a difference. And to your point, Jonathan, I partnered up with the right people. One of the things I think we do as filmmakers or storytellers, we try to reach too far, too high above us. We try to get a hold of Spielberg. And Spielberg, you know, it's not that he's like a bad guy and all that stuff. And oh man, he's too far ahead of us. He's just not in our arena. He is too high, right? You need to be looking at who's to your right, who's to your left in your industry and cross-functionally in your industry. And I think you're exactly right. They can't be so low that you're pulling them up, but sides raises all ships. And you find a company, like I found a gaming company where they had just done a Kickstarter. They raised a bunch of money on Kickstarter. I had questions about board games. And so I went to them, and before I know it, you know, we're all collaborating. And now I'm helping them on their projects. They're helping me on my projects. And it's been a very good relationship. If I had waited a little bit longer, they'd have been too far ahead of me, you know? And so you got to find people that are in your, at your level, maybe a little bit of further ahead and a little bit behind is fine, but you don't want it to be so far out of reach either way that you're not pulling each other along. And I do think you can find those people that are good fits for you. I think people want to collaborate.
Exactly. No, I agree with you. I think you need to just find people who are in everything. Of course. All right, now I can hear you guys. So there you go. No, I was like saying that you got to find people that are in your wheelhouse, you know, exactly. You know, and it's tough sometimes because, you know, it's a lot of networking and a lot of people that you don't know, you know.
You also get a ton of no's. You know, it is also a control thing. You know, you can't go in thinking that, hey, it's my way or the highway. This is my story, because nobody's going to want that. They're not going to want to be a part of that. They don't want to do your project. They want to do a collective project together. You know, let's do a project together. That's what people want to hear. Not, hey, do you want to do my project? It's like, no, hire me and I'll do your project. But if you want all of us to do it, then let's come up with something together and invite them into the creative process. And then I think you have an opportunity. The moment you start going in, dictating, and I know this is hard to do because a lot of these stories are our babies, but you have to be willing for the good of the story to kind of put it up on the altar and invite people into the process to allow the story to be even better than you could have made it.
Exactly. Well, I think this is going to wrap it up. Do you have any words of wisdom to any aspiring filmmakers out there?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, filmmaking is a collective. It's just like life. It's not meant to be a solo sport. You don't have to do this alone. You're not an island unto yourself. There are people out there that want to help you, that are willing to help you. If you do fantasy and sci-fi, I can tell you right now, as the CEO of the Fantasy Network, we'd be interested. You know, we all want to come together to be able to help each other out. I think that's important to know, because as the world gets smaller, we all start to become more collective. We need to be able to recognize that there's people out there that are willing to help and that do want to help you. We're better together than we are apart. We have a louder voice coming together. And I would just encourage you to find your group, find your tribe of people to be creative with and to get your stories told.
Very cool.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how can people reach you, or like, do you have a website that people can check out?
Definitely, I have several. So the Forge Studios, like an Anvil Forge, theforgestudios.com is my production company. I do co-own the fantasy.network, which is a streaming platform. film@theforgestudios.com. You can also find me on Instagram and Facebook, of course, and all the different social media platforms, but film@theforgestudios.com is the best email to connect with me. And if you have questions or ideas or whatever it is, let me know. I'm happy to help if I can.
Cool. Awesome. And is that Fantasy Network on Roku?
It is. We do have a Roku app. Yeah, we do have a couple apps. So we're on Apple, Android, Roku. So you can go pull the app down and watch 95% of our content. My whole library is up there. You can watch 95% of our content for free. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And we'll definitely want you back on the show. So
great. Love to be back. Appreciate y'all having me.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah.
Anna, did you have any last words or anything to ask?
No, I'm good right now. He answered a lot of stuff that I was curious about, like in detail. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you.
I didn't expect you to go into detail as much about the whole how you choose your actors and stuff. And you gave every detail. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Hopefully I was specific enough to where people can take actionable items, because I believe in that.
Yeah.
Definitely. Okay. So we're going to, you guys stick around, and everybody else, thank you guys for listening so much, and have a great rest of your week, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Take care.